It's 7 minutes past 10. I'm Kara Lawrence. And the Kalamazoo Philharmonia performs on Saturday. Here to talk about it is conductor Andrew Kohler once again. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back. We had a good time last time talking about the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Concert featuring Stolberg, bronze medalist.
Yes, right.
And I trust that was an exciting performance.
It was, yeah. It went really well. And it was a real pleasure to have Austin, and I think the orchestra made some great strides in that concert.
You asked a lot of them, if I recall.
Yes.
So it's been since November, since the last Kalamazoo Philharmonia concert.
Right.
And we often come and just pick up right where we left off, but maybe it's not a bad idea to remind listeners what the Kalamazoo Philharmonia is.
Oh, yeah. Well, our tagline is that we are the orchestra of Kalamazoo College and community. So Kalamazoo College, being a relatively small school, I can't always be certain that there will be, you know, three great bassoon players in the student body. And so historically, it's come to pass that the orchestra is organized with a lot of community members, some of whom are professional musicians, some of whom are not, and just enthusiastic amateurs, and also students. And we mix them all together. So it's a really kind of excitingly motley crew of people of all ages. But what unites us is obviously the love of orchestral music and the chance to perform this kind of repertoire and share it with our audience.
Yeah, and I think the last part can't be stressed enough. The chance to perform some of the repertoire that you're able to do as an orchestra is really, it's the gold ring for players.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of excitement in there, and I work really hard to try and, you know, in a lot of senses, I think there are those in the orchestra who enjoy most playing the sort of canonical pieces we get to do, and then there are some who really enjoy something that I am particularly passionate about, which is to explore less known regions of the repertoire, and we try and mix them together and always find a balance, and that's exactly what we will be doing on this program. And in the end, you know, the orchestra used to be called the Kalamazoo College and Community Orchestra, which was a great name, on the nose, and I thought that I wanted to rename it the Philharmonia principally because Philharmonia, love of harmony, love of music, seemed to me a more fitting description of what it is that brings us together rather than our various constituent parts.
And under your direction, you've also looked into reaching out and collaborating with a number of different organizations and other strong musical groups.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of the more lasting ones has been with the Bach Festival. That's obviously a very natural kind of relationship because they're also tangentially related to Kalamazoo College. And we've had many good concerts together and hope that we will have more in the future. And certainly we've had all kinds of exciting soloists from all sorts of different places come in and work with us. And that's an ongoing joy for us.
A little bird told me there may be an opera project coming up a couple seasons from now, but we'll get there when we get there.
Some things still in the works. Always some adventures ahead.
Okay. This concert is called Between Worlds. Let's start there.
Yeah. So as I was mentioning, this is another one of our programs that mixes a canonical work, which in this case is the From the New World Symphony No. 9 by Antonín Dvořák, which I think is, for good reason, one of the most beloved pieces in the repertoire. And it mixes that with two other pieces by his fellow Czech countrymen. One is Josef Suk. This is a piece by him, relatively early piece by him, called The Fantastic Scherzo. And then that's followed by a really imposing and unusual work called The Sinfonietta, The Little Symphony, by Leos Janáček, one of his very late works, in fact. For various reasons, the Suk isn't performed very often for reasons that utterly escape me, because it's for a very normal-sized orchestra, and it's very tricky. It's difficult to play, but certainly there are other tricky things that orchestras play all the time. And it's an absolutely dazzling piece. I was so bowled over by it when I first came across it, and I thought, how is it that I've never heard this before? It's got, as its name implies, it's not necessarily about any particular, say, fairy tale or some sort of story, but it does seem to conjure a spirit of imagination and wonder. And so in that very abstracted sense, it gets at that kind of feeling. And it has this cello tune that appears twice in the initial section. The scherzo, of course, is a dance form. And it's a dance form that's been used since the days of Haydn. It basically was just a sped-up minuet. So it's a pulse in 1, 2, 3 that is felt fast enough that it's between feeling all three and just one big pulse with three component parts. And as this dance moves along, you can hear lots of energy in it, lots of a forward drive. Then there comes this absolutely luscious soaring theme for the cellos, which I think is kind of, something like an equivalent or a close neighbor of another famous Czech tune, that of Smetana's Moldau. Sounds a little bit to me that way, or at least it captures a little bit of that flowing spirit that was meant to represent a river, and this also seems to have that quality, but somehow even higher. It's soaring instead of just flowing somehow. And then Suk manages a really beautiful transition into a central section, which is much slower and has these gorgeous little pas de deux for various wind instruments, you know, little dialogues back and forth. And then, once again, he really loves the cello. The cellos have a good time in this piece because that also becomes a sort of background to another gorgeous cello theme, which is one of those moments where you really feel, I feel this often with Dvorak as well, who, by the way, was Suk's father-in-law and principal teacher.
Yeah.
So there's a close kinship there. But I feel this way about both composers. There's just such a wealth of melodic material that it's almost embarrassing. I mean, it's the kind of thing, Brahms had a great quote about Dvorak where he said, you know, the scraps of his second themes, the things that he discards, would be great first themes for the rest of us. We would be so lucky as to have a melody that good. And sure enough, here is another absolutely sumptuously gorgeous cello melody that he opens up in the middle section. And then eventually all that material from the opening repeats, but before it does, there's a cello quartet, the cello section divided into four parts that sing kind of a very quiet hymn. Seems very removed, but it's a very special, very intimate moment before the dance and the excitement and the liveliness all return. But I think we can perhaps at least listen up to the repeat of that first section, so we'll get the beginning, this middle section, and this hymn that I described.
I'm excited to hear this scherzo, this fantastic scherzo of Joseph Suk, my first experience with it. And the concert again is 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Light Fine Arts Center on the Kay College campus. That's music of Joseph Suk, the son-in-law of Antonín Dvořák. We're hearing music new to me and many of you, the fantastic scherzo. It's a piece programmed by my guest, Andrew Kohler. And that is one of your specialties, to find neglected pieces that really should see the light of day much more often.
I mean, it's something that I just enjoy. I love getting to know new music, you know, and I think that although I have such towering respect, as all musicians do, for the great canonical masterpieces that we do, and there's always a place to hear them again and hear them in different ways. It just, you know, when you come across a work like this, I just feel flabbergasted. Why is this not heard? I don't know. Sometimes, you know, it's really legitimate. I think history has cast a pretty good, I'll come across a piece and I'll think, I can understand why not too many people know this. You know, it just doesn't, something doesn't quite work about it. But then there are other times when you come across things like this Suk Fantastic Scherzo, which I just think is a perfect piece of music. And you just wonder, something about the vagaries of history that have caused it to go relatively little known outside of, I think, its native Bohemia.
This is the work that begins the program Between Worlds. And earlier, I think you alluded to between the worlds of the, you know, the famous canonical pieces and the lesser known. Also, I can see a connection between worlds of the old and the new.
Yeah, clearly. And in fact, that's one of the things that I was specifically getting at with the Suk. You know, he was writing with a very up-to-date, this was written in 1904, but he was writing with a very up-to-date chromatic language that other composers throughout the continent were using at the time. And yet, he was writing on this theme of this fantastic, right, some imagination. That was something that was much more associated with the early Romantics in the earlier 19th century. By now, most composers had were tending to go towards grittier, more realistic themes in their music. But yet here was this real escapist kind of entertainment from Suk. So there was a little bit of the old and the new. And of course, I think this music kind of, particularly this music, aims to bring us out into a fantastical new world, something outside of our everyday reality. So it kind of does hover between those two worlds, as does the next piece on our program by Leoš Janáček. And in this case, his Sinfonietta is one of his last works. It's really amazing. Janáček is a composer who, well, he's just in between the ages of Dvorak and Suk, a little bit closer to the age of Dvorak. And it wasn't until the 20s, basically, the late teens and 20s, that in his 60s, he had a flowering sort of late creative resurgence. A lot of people attribute it to his having met this younger woman whom he never really consummated any kind of actual affair with. It just seems like they traded a lot of letters, and he certainly felt very strongly about her, but enough so that that all of a sudden all this music kept flowing out of him. And it came at a very great time, I suppose. If you're going to have a creative resurgence, 60 is a good time to have it, because at least as this was the case with Janáček, you're a complete master of your craft at this point. And B, you just don't care what anybody else thinks by that point. You know, you're not too worried about fitting in or saying the right thing or sounding, fashionable enough to fit in. And I can think of few composers who have such an unbelievably distinctive voice. Janáček just sounds absolutely like no one else. He has such a clear idea of what it is that he wants to write. And it's so impractical. If it were lesser music, I think I would be completely annoyed by how impractical this music is. And what I mean by that is he tends to write such unusual, unexpected harmonies, and he writes the notes in the harmonies even in an unusual way. So they're very difficult for the musicians to read. It's not written in a way that feels logical for musicians to execute. And then on top of it, he's so impractical with his orchestration. In this piece in particular, for example, there are five movements of the Sinfonietta. Bassoons play in the second movement, and then they have about three notes in the fourth movement, and then they're tacit in all the other movements. On the other hand, he calls for as many as 12 trumpets at one part, and it's just kind of like, at this moment, he obviously so clearly heard a particular sound and wanted that to happen. And it just didn't matter to him whether that was, you know, it was easy to achieve that sound. He just said, here are the things you need to do to be able to achieve the sound. But the incredible thing is often the case with great composers like this, if you go for it, if you trust him, you realize he's right. as big of a pain as it is, if you try and do what he's asked for, it creates an incredible sound. And it's folk inflected. You can hear some of Dvorak's influence in that way. And the other way that you can hear it is, you know, of course, Dvorak himself used folk melody, and he did so in a kind of bid for nationalism. most of Janáček's life, of course. What we now know today is the Czech Republic, his homeland would have been a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it wasn't until after World War I that finally he had a chance to see what became at that time Czechoslovakia be a free and sovereign and independent nation. And I think those are the worlds that we're navigating in this piece, because the Sinfonietta is very much a celebration of the freedom of Czech people, of their newfound sovereignty. And in fact, he said this piece is meant to express the freedom of man and his, I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, and his victorious spirit to fight for that freedom.
I thought this was written for some athletic games or something.
So you're right about that. That's absolutely the case. There was a gymnastic festival called the Sokol Festival. And technically, it was a commission for that huge gymnastic festival. But I think we lose a little bit of the sense of the political, overtly political nature of that organization, the Sokol Gymnastic Organization. They were very much already in the late 19th century an athletic organization that was dedicated to the cause of Czech nationalism. So yes, on the surface of things, it was about, the human body and gymnastics and athleticism. But that organization was very much about uniting people in these exercises and also sowing the seeds of Czech nationalism. So the fact that they were having this festival in 1926 was indeed a very big celebration of what would have at that time been coming up on, I'm at not quite the 10-year mark of a free and independent Czechoslovakia.
The work is Janáček's Sinfonietta. It's the second work on the program on Saturday. The program begins at 8 p.m. in the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College with Andrew Kohler conducting the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Shall we hear the opening of the Sinfonietta?
I think the opening is a great place to start, and it's got this incredible and legendary, I think, fanfare, which you'll hear ties very well to the gymnastic festival theme that we were just discussing.
That's the opening to the Sinfonietta by Janáček. That brass is so impressive.
It is really dazzling. And of course, there's no strings involved or no winds. It's just in that one movement, he decided what I need is the sound of a brass band. And indeed, that's precisely what he was aiming to capture, because the impetus of this work, he had already gotten he had been asked to take this commission on for the Sokol Gymnastic Festivals we were discussing. And he went to visit this this young love of his, this younger woman in her native city, and he heard a military band play something off in the distance. And he was so excited, he sketched down in his notebook some of the tunes. And of course, they bear no resemblance really to the ultimate product that he came out, but it was the sound, the atmosphere, that notion of that steeliness that he wanted to capture. And he thought, I think it felt very much a celebration of independence, as we were discussing.
Speaking of steeliness, I think John Williams may have had a little stealing in mind when he wrote the NBC Olympic theme.
Yeah, I know it. Yes, I think so. And of course, naturally, they all derive, right? Any kind of this fanfare type music derives ultimately from military music. So very, very heavy on the brass. So I think there's a natural kinship there. The interesting thing with Janáček is he's also, I mean, we're talking so much about his politics right here, but he makes the political personal as well. And in the successive movements of this piece, which I think I think we might listen to maybe one of these just to get an idea of the range of textures that happen in any given movement. What Janáček does is tie a kind of an image from his adopted home city of Brno to each movement. The second movement is meant to be this old castle. It's called the Old Castle, and it's a castle up on the hill in the middle of Brno. The third movement is supposed to be the Queen's Monastery. The fourth is just the street, and there's the energy of the street. And the fifth is the town hall. I think maybe we could listen to a little bit of the Queen's Monastery. This is a place where Janáček spent a lot of time as a young man, actually, when he first moved to Brno. He played the organ there, and again, it's difficult to know. I don't want to lead the listener to think in any way that this is a tone painting of a place, because it doesn't seem that way. There's nothing on the surface of it that makes you think, ah, well, that sounds very much like a monastery. Here he is hinting at chant or something like that, or some religious music. None of that seems to be here for Janáček. It seems like it's a very personal memory, something about maybe a moment he had in there, inside the space. Maybe he heard wind gusting in, and just that impression somehow stayed with him, and he ties it to this place. So it's difficult for us to unpack, I guess, as listeners outside of his mind, exactly what he gets at. But again, the depth of his imagination is such that it's still totally captivating. The reason in particular I gave that example of wind gusting is because I can say with certainty one thing that he did say about this particular movement, the third movement, the Queen's Monastery movement. There are some flute scales that you'll hear in here that are very nearly impossible. They go a mile a minute. And the flutist of the premiere performance said to Janáček, you know, it's practically unplayable what you've written. And he said, it doesn't really matter what you play. It just has to sound like the wind. And that's what he said to him. And that kind of atmospheric conjuring is so much what I think defines Janáček's style, these incredible, and you'll hear, almost cinematic kind of cuts from one idea to the next. We start with a very romantic theme in this third movement, and then we shift to a very harrowing theme with the trombones, and then we hear some of these wind gusts, the romance comes back, and then a trombone solo that sounds sort of like a runaway freight train.
Before we hear it, let me remind listeners that this concert is set for 8 o'clock on Saturday night, March 4th, at Kalamazoo College in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Center. It's a ticketed event. Tickets available at the door, or look online at kazoo.edu/philharmonia. And as we are 15 minutes away from the, or 20 minutes away from the top of the hour, still to come, we will be talking about the great New World Symphony of Dvorak. Here's the third movement of Janáček's Sinfonietta. Music from the Sinfonietta by Leos Janáček, as helpfully explained by Andrew Kohler, who will conduct the piece on Saturday. I think I liked it better when I didn't know how hard it was. It's such a...
No, it makes you appreciate it all the more, right? I mean, that we've committed to making this happen somehow. That's, I mean, it's been a huge undertaking for us. I'll be honest, and I know there's some in the orchestra that that give me a little bit of look a little askance at me, but as soon as we can get to a spot, and we're just getting there now, where we really understand the musical content and can get outside of our own, the challenges that each part presents, I think we'll be as swept up in this as the audience will be, I hope.
I will say that more and more, I talk to performers of all kinds, but probably mostly pianists, who are really bringing back Janáček as much as they possibly can. He did miss out in a way of in being appreciated during his time.
I think so, yeah, because as we were saying, he had such a late flowering in his life, and at this point, a lot of musical tastes had already moved on in another direction. Certainly, he doesn't sound exactly romantic. He does sound somewhat modern, but already modernism was going in some different trends by the 20s when he was writing something like this. It's a little bit one foot in the past and one foot in the present. So that those are his two worlds that he's straddling, as well as, of course, the worlds of a sovereign Czechoslovakia and one under the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Well, I might hear a little bit of Janáček color in Bernard Herrmann's film scores and his love of brass sectional.
Scoring. I can imagine that.
Well, we have about 12 minutes left in this hour and a huge piece to talk about, but luckily it's one that many people already know and love, Symphony No. 9.
Yes, and this is perhaps the piece which most exemplifies this notion between two worlds in the most literal sense. It's one of the most often told but most fascinating stories, I think, in music history. Antonín Dvořák, had managed to become a sort of international celebrity as a musician in the late 19th century. And what he had done so successfully was build on the ideas of his slightly older contemporary, Bedřich Smetana, in terms of using particularly folk-inspired music. I mean, Dvořák didn't tend to use actual folk themes so much as he tended to just write themes that sounded like they had a folk quality.
Which would end up sometimes becoming folk.
Exactly, as is the case in this piece. And he did so successfully that, you know, like I say, he managed a really international reputation. He managed to take the sort of fundamentally Germanic symphonic form and imbue it with kind of a Czech nationalism, a Czech consciousness, and one that was appreciated around the world. Because he did this so successfully, in the late 19th century, America was starting to kind of sow its oats a little bit and feel like we wanted to have a more distinctive personality as well. American composers at that time tended, if they were at all serious, to go to Europe, get serious training there, and then come back and make very dutiful kind of emulations of whatever style they had studied in, whether it was probably Paris or Berlin or Vienna or one of those major capitals. So a woman named Jeanette Thurber, who was the head of this newly established conservatory, National Conservatory of Music in New York, said, "What if we brought Mr. Dvořák over here and asked him to tell us how we might create an American sound in the way that he's created a Czech sound?" And so this she did with quite a lot of money, and Dvořák came over. And in short order, he had an idea. He said, "I think that with the inspiration of Native American music and with the inspiration of Black spirituals, you have all the musical material you would need for a full and rich symphonic tradition."
I'm amazed at how conscious that was.
Yes, like,
how
right.
deliberate. We need our own music, and let's get Dvořák over here to help us find it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, it really mattered, I think, to people, and that was a time when already Emerson had called, right? Let's cast off the muses of Europe. Let's find our own sound. Well, not necessarily sound he was talking about, but our own art in America. So I think that was in the consciousness already. People were actively seeking a way for America to distinguish itself. It was growing in power and prestige, and political might. And so, yes, that was Dvořák's suggestion. And as you can imagine, that was met with some resistance. I mean, there were plenty of people who felt that was not the America that they wanted to celebrate. But nonetheless, Dvořák thought, well, let me not simply tell you this, but let me demonstrate to you how it might be done. And he did so most famously in this wonderful work, From the New World, his Symphony No. 9, which in many cases, the inner movements are meant to... were actually inspired by the Longfellow poem, The Song of Hiawatha. And the tunes in them in all the piece seem often very closely related to Black spirituals. There's actually a moment in the second theme of the first movement that sounds very much like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, just a little bit. And then maybe even the more famous tune is the slow tune, the English horn melody from the second movement of the Dvorak. And in this case, it's kind of a reverse situation where he wrote something that so convincingly sounded like a spiritual that it was turned into one subsequently, given the title Going Home. So lyrics were put to it, but it is Dvorak's original tune. And I think maybe we could take a quick listen to the second movement, which starts with magisterial brass chords and then opens up into this gorgeous lamenting tune for the English horn.
Well, that's a Berlin recording, Klaus Tennstedt conducting the second movement of the Dvorak Symphony No. 9 from the New World. And my guest Andrew Kohler has to leave soon and continue preparing for Saturday night's concert. It's been so nice having you here again and hearing your thoughts on the music. There's an awful lot to this symphony we can't really get to, but the final movement, I'm hoping we'll hear a little bit
sure.
to take us out.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You were just mentioning a second ago, you said something about John Williams sort of taking a page from Janáček. But if he's taken a more direct page from anywhere, it might be this last movement. I think your listeners will recognize a sort of half-step theme that will be quite familiar. It sounds quite a bit like Jaws. and that's the sort of grip of terror in which the last movement begins. I don't think your listeners will, you know, right now on the air will be able to get to the very end of the movement, but it's a really fascinating finale. It's great and it's energetic and it has something that almost sounds like a hoedown in it in a way. And at the very end, as we're approaching it, Dvorak, it's truly magnificent. He repeats several of the themes from earlier in the symphony, and it seems like bar by bar we're taken from triumph to resignation to wonder. I mean, he just pulls us in so many different directions. And the very final note of the symphony, I think, is so telling because it drives to an exciting conclusion, but then holds the last note and lets it fade out quietly. And I think this is the perfect kind of note for his experience in the New World. He was terribly homesick while he was here, but he also saw amazing things and was impressed by what he saw. And I think there's this tone of uncertainty that he sets there. There's infinite possibility, but he's not quite sure what will happen. And I think that's a very adequate summing up of his experience with the New World.
His ninth symphony, did he write it 10th?
He did not.
This is the last one for mm-hmm. him, as for many others. And I believe he sailed home with the cello concerto in his suitcase.
That's right. Mm. Another really important, very deeply personal piece for him.
Yeah. So his time in America was well spent in many ways.
True.
And before we hear the final movement, Andrew, I have been repeating a trope about poor John Williams, and I actually don't want to leave it at that. And I think a film composer who uses great themes and borrows so-called borrowing, that's what all film composers have done from the beginning of film.
Well, all composers, period. right? There's that famous line that good composers borrow, great composers steal. And that's right. That means they steal it, they make it truly their own, and they turn it into something totally different.
Williams is one of the best. And so, of course, is this famous symphony. It'll be performed at 8 o'clock on Saturday at the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College. There's a tickets available at the door, or you can look online at kazoo.edu/philharmonia. And thank you so much for coming in, Andrew.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.